A translation by Srila Prabhupada. I have killed many friends of women, and I have thus caused enmity to such an extent that it is not possible to undo it by material welfare work. Purport. The Grihamedis are those whose only business is to perform welfare work for the sake of material prosperity. Such material prosperity is sometimes hampered by sinful activities. For the materialist is sure to commit sins, even unintentionally, in the course of discharging material duties. To get relief from such sinful reactions, the Vedas prescribe several kinds of sacrifices. It is said in the Vedas that by performing the Ashvamedha Yajna, horse sacrifice, one can get relief from even Brahmahatya, killing of a Brahmana. Yudhishthir Maharaj performed this Ashvamedha Yajna, but he thinks that even by performing such yajnas, it is not possible to get relief from the great sins committed. In war, either the husband or the brother, or even the father or sons go to fight. And when they are killed, a fresh enmity is created, and thus a chain of actions and reactions increases, which is not possible to be counteracted even by thousands of Ashvamedha yajnas. The way of work karma is like that. It creates one action and another reaction simultaneously, and thus increases the chain of material activities, binding the performer in material bondage. In the Bhagavad Gita, the remedy suggested that such actions and reactions of the path of work can be checked only when work is done on behalf of the Supreme Lord. The battle of Kurukshetra was actually fought by the will of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, as is evident from his version, and only by his will was Yudhishthir placed on the throne of Hastinapur. Therefore, factually, no sin whatsoever touched the Pandavas, who were only the order carriers of the Lord. For others who declare war out of personal interest, the whole responsibility lies on them. Srila Prabhupada ki. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakya Chakshnun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So a very philosophically laden purport, and this is in this section of Yudhishthira's lamentation, which follows a wonderful poetic glorification of the Lord by Queen Kunti. So that has occupied most of chapter 8. And of course she offered her prayers after who was punished? Or who was saved rather? In the womb of Uttara, Parikshit Maharaj was saved. And that prompted Queen Kunti to offer these wonderful prayers to Krishna. And well, those prayers have been accepted by the Lord, who it is said mildly smiled. That was his acceptance of them. Yet, however, there's another side still going on in this Leela, and that is that Yudhishthira Maharaj, who was the head of the Pandavas, the leader of the brothers, he was feeling that he had committed so much violence during this war, that he has a huge range of sinful reactions lined up, which cannot even be refuted by the standard process of repentance or performance of yajna. So we can learn a few things from this episode, that first of all, it is possible that if we have committed sinful activities, to actually negate in some way the reactions to those by performing Vedic methods, by the process of yajna. Here in particular, Ashvamedha yajna is described. And Ashvamedha yajna is I don't think anyone really could perform that today, but it's something that kings especially did in order to overcome the large amounts of sin they commit as a routine course of their activities, but also to gain great power and strength in order to rule the world. So that's one item that's mentioned, Ashvamedha yajna. Just to perform that yajna requires such a collection of wealth, subservience. The kings have to, whoever's performing that, has to travel throughout the world and subjugate all other kings so that they remain the undisputed emperor. And so who can do that? There's hardly any country that can claim they've subjugated all others. Each country is portraying or pushing forward their own agenda, their own strengths. But no one can really say they've done that. There are multiple power centers in this world. But in Yudhishthir's time, when these great kings performed these yajnas, they conquered absolutely everyone. And all the kings that were conquered offered their dues, offered tribute to the emperor. So that's one item that's recommended, and it's especially recommended for kings. But for people in general, the Vedic literature is full of different things that one can do. If one is desirous of reaching the heavenly kingdoms, there are certain sacrifices, certain procedures that can be performed according to Karmakanda standards or other standards. Then, if someone has committed sinful acts, there's a range of different things that one can do in order to free oneself from particular type of sin. Krishna himself also sometimes acknowledges that sin is incurred. I mean, Krishna can't incur sin. He is well beyond the whole system of sinful behavior, karma, prarabdha, bija, kuta, all of these details that we study. Krishna is well beyond those. But sometimes, after killing a demon, he feels himself to be impure. After killing someone in the guise of a brahmana, he feels that he's impure to some extent. And then a whole pastime takes place where he has to purify himself. And of course, this leads to a lot of joy and a lot of enjoyment for the devotees, and leads to, thankfully, special pastimes, and we now have pastime places based on those. Radha Kund, Shama Kunda, one such incident, due to the killing of a bull. Really, these both arose as part of Krishna's atonement. But so we get this idea that atonement is possible. And in the past, if someone committed some sinful act, they would go and see the right person, see the expert. Maybe there's a certain version of it which was predominant in this part of the world as well, through the notion of confession, where individuals would go to the confession box, confess what they've done, and the priest would forgive them, pardon them. But as time has gone on, the potency of the priest has decreased. And rather than being something that maybe a person would make a trip once in their life to the confession box, now, as Prabhupada said, it's a process of repeated sinning and repeated requests for atonement. We perform something sinful, and then we expect to be freed from it. And as soon as that's happened, we do the same thing again and go back again and again and again. So such repeated throwing dust, bathing and throwing dust over the elephant. This is condemned in the Vedic scripture. The elephant has a nice bath. And then, after he's had a nice bath and he's nice and clean, he comes out and throws dust all over himself. Something a bit like talcum powder, maybe. I don't know if you, when you were young, you may have had a bath and your mum may have put some talcum powder on you. So, it's similar. That you've had a nice clean bath and now you've contaminated yourself again with some other substance. So it's okay, but the analogy here is that the elephant is clean, but then he's become contaminated again. And so when someone cleans themselves through the process of sacrifice, yajna, or some Vedic ritual, they should stay that way. They shouldn't then undo all those results by sinning again. That is the purpose here. But we see that sinful actions continue. And in today's day and age, the idea of repentance, the idea of seeking forgiveness, that part has just disappeared. Because people just refuse to accept and acknowledge that there is a supreme person in charge, who is the rule giver. Now, it's not actually necessary for there to be a concept of a rule giver just in order for people to follow material life in a more wholesome manner. There's many different philosophies. The Karma Mimamsa philosophy, with practitioners of that philosophy, which is a large number, they understand the idea of karma. They understand the idea of repeated birth and death, the idea that according to our activities we will get a result. But they don't see that That whole system is superintended and operated and managed by the Supreme Lord. They see that it is just a system. As Krishna says in the Gita, they think this world is produced just of sex attraction and has no cause other than lust. They actually refuse to acknowledge the presence of the Supreme Lord behind it, even if they may accept the mechanism. Now that's not particularly intelligent, because every single mechanism that we can see in this world always has a creator behind it. Is there any creation? Is it that this microphone has just popped into existence without some design, creation, manufacturing, quality control involved? Is there any example that anyone can give where some creation is there, in human society at least, and we cannot attribute it to some method of creation, some intelligence? It's there. So the same thing actually applies to all the laws of nature, all the universal laws. There has, for every law, there has to be a lawmaker. And this is one of the basic principles of the philosophy as Srila Prabhupada has explained it to us. When we acknowledge the existence of the lawmaker, and we dovetail our activities to the wishes, and we honor the constraints placed upon us by the lawmaker, and those laws are given to us in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavad Gita, in scripture in general, perhaps even in other sub-scriptural literatures like Manusamhita and others, which are codes of conduct for behavior. There are many, many guidelines for human society. And if we follow those, if we act in accordance with the wishes of the lawmaker, then we will please the lawmaker. And we will get a result which is not possible by simply operating in this world of birth and death. As I mentioned, those who follow this Karma Mimamsa philosophy, they perform yajñas, they perform sacrifices with the aim of elevation. But that type of elevation is really condemned even in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhogaishvariya prasaktanam daya paharati chetasam vyavasayatmika buddhir samadona vidyate traigunya vishaya veda nistraigunya bhavarjuna. So those whose minds are too attracted to sense gratification and who are simply desirous of heavenly upliftment, for them the resolute determination for devotional service simply cannot arise. When someone is engaged in sense gratification, as Prabhupada explains here in this first paragraph, a person automatically commits sins. Now we have to stop and think about that for a moment, because normally sense gratification appears to be a very harmless thing. What's wrong with a little enjoyment? Isn't it? I have a chocolate bar, I go on a nice walk, I do this, I that, I enjoy nature, I eat something tasty, I have some fun with someone. What's wrong? Don't be so miserable. That's what Kami say to the devotees. Don't be so miserable. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy your senses. But they don't know this next bit. That when someone is addicted or is constantly working for the pursuit of sense gratification, well, as the Gita says, the first thing that happens is vyavasyatmika buddhi disappears. Your clear-pointed intelligence disappears. Because when you're in a mood of enjoyment, you don't have clarity. So then decisions that are made are not wholesome and the best for us. The second very practical thing is that if our mental capacity, if a portion of it or a large portion of it is engaged in the pursuit of sense gratification, we have very little left to do anything else with. Most people don't have vast minds where they can carry out multiple tasks to a high standard. We can either focus on one thing or another, pretty much. If we are multitasking, then we're devoting parts of our energy to those tasks, but not the full amount. So in spiritual life, we really need to devote the full amount. So this is why this process of material growth, material elevation, the aspiration for it is so deadly. Because one commits sinful acts, whether they want to or not. Just in order for us to enjoy anything involves suffering on someone else's part. It's often very hidden. Every so often, someone in the world will create, or there'll be a campaign which is launched, I remember one campaign from a few years ago to protect the coffee growers who are being exploited. Because in the West, huge amounts of coffee would be consumed. And it would be at the cost of really exploiting a few individuals on farms in certain countries who are producing that. So then there was this massive campaign. Let's pay the coffee workers a correct, reasonable salary. Well, it doesn't solve the problem. Because that's just one item. That's just one item of enjoyment which we have identified has produced a consequence for someone else. Now, simply paying someone more rarely solves the problem. What is the natural consequence when wages increase? What else increases? Inflation goes up. Your wage naturally buys you a lot less. So we see that in different places. We often have a misguided idea that if someone appears to be poor, that that problem will be solved by supplying funds. We see many misguided charitable acts carried out. And you go, you take pity on individuals who appear to have nothing. You give them lots of wealth. There may be government schemes to do that. You go back 10 years later, and the person is just as poor. Because although they have a large number of numbers now to their name, they still can't do anything with it. And not only that, they don't even know what to do with it. So to actually use wealth properly requires some training. It requires some understanding. How should wealth be spent or misspent? Prabhupada would always comment that here in the West, people are very, very intelligent. There is a great deal of intelligence that has gone into construction of this material society. To construct a skyscraper is no simple task. It requires huge amounts of intelligence. Skyscrapers, theme parks, aeroplanes, the whole construction, you look at it, the food processes, the industrialization, huge amounts of intelligence has gone into it. But it has not actually made everyone very, very happy. Depression is on the increase. Now it is practically the largest consumer of NHS time, above and beyond actual disease. Mental issues. People being unhappy, even though they actually now, on paper, have everything. They have comforts. They have tasty items. They have all the items of sense enjoyment they can acquire from any part of the world. Yet people are unhappy. You would think that if the propaganda was working, and by material progress people would become happy, you would actually see that. But you don't see it. Rather, we simply see the propaganda becoming more and more stronger and more convoluted. So I've just mentioned one item with coffee growers. But there's so many others. Every single thing that we consume has had a consequence of some description for someone else. And most of those consequences we don't even think about. There's wholesale industries which are dedicated to supplying people meat products. They don't want to think for a moment of the dreadful consequences of the animals in that food chain. What is happening to them? Just so someone can sit and enjoy their burger, which is being portrayed as a high point of civilization. The idea that you can have a burger at any time, anywhere. This is success. Well, it's very, very degraded. And as devotees, we feel very sad to actually observe this. There's wholesale slaughter going on every single day. Millions around the world every single day. Someone is always suffering. The pursuit of sense gratification leads directly to suffering for someone or other. And if anyone suffers as a result of our pursuit of sense gratification, there is a reaction for us. There are no two ways about it. I believe in yesterday's class there was a discussion and the point was made, I can't remember by who, that the system of karma, it's not based on emotion. It is a rigid system. It's a system. The laws are the laws. And if you've done something wrong and you're due to get a reaction for it, you will be given that. Even if you cry and even if you complain and even if you piteously say, oh, I didn't know what I was doing. The fact is, the system is the system. And we adopted this system and we entered into it, we've forgotten our decision to do so. That is one of the problems, that we have forgotten our decision to enter this world, as Prabhupada said. We wanted to be separate from Krishna, and Krishna gave us this opportunity. Okay, you can be the boss to some extent, but you can't be the ultimate boss, because everyone else also wants to be the ultimate boss. So it's not actually possible what you want. But I'll give you a system, I'll give you a mechanism of action and reaction where you can put effort and you can acquire the results of your efforts over time, over lifetimes. You can have all the enjoyment possible in all the different species of life. And you can experience sense enjoyment as much as you like. But there is a mechanism that also goes along with this little privilege. And that is the mechanism of karma. So when we act in a certain way, we accrue piety and we accrue sin. And both of those then determine our future journey through life. It is said, we hear that 100 lives worth of karma dictates our next birth. Just imagine, as Prabhupada indicates here, how complex this system is. We do something, it has a knock-on effect. The result of that won't be felt, say, for 53 lifetimes. At that point, we may get something that has fructified from our actions now, combined with everything, combined with the situation, and that will result for us in a birth, in a particular species, in a particular family, in a particular culture, in a particular country, in a particular planet. And in that birth, we will have certain facilities, certain disadvantages, and we will have another experience. During that, we will accrue even more karma, and we will simply be entangled. So that is the consequence of the path of sense gratification. Lord Rishabhdev, when he's explaining to his sons this philosophy, he explains that Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma yat indriya pritaya aprinoti na sadhu manye yat atmanoyam asan apiklesha ashadeha. That when one is addicted to sense gratification, one automatically commits sinful acts. A person does not understand that the body he has received now is due to his previous actions. Therefore, I do not consider it very wise that a person engages themselves in the pursuit of sense gratification by which he receives bodies again and again. The body is such a source of trouble. So should we carry on activities which create trouble for us further and further into the future? Now that's the very philosophically strong point that's made there. That if one is intelligent, one starts to question, one starts to consider, what can I do to extract myself from this horrendous system? It is something that no one can identify. You can't understand where our karma has begun, because it is such a complicated mesh. But thankfully we do have different items to help us. One of the items is given here, sacrifice. By performing sacrifice, you can reduce your sinful actions. That you can reduce the reactions to your sinful actions. But there is a little problem with that. Okay, the reaction may go. Let's assume someone performs a certain activity. What are two things that happen every time an activity is performed, any activity? One of them is, as we've mentioned, reaction. There's some reaction, some consequence, could be some pious result, some impious result. And there's also something else that happens. Yes, something happens in the consciousness, some vasana, something is there, some impression is left in the consciousness. Well, dreams is later, and it may or may not happen, but something happens as an impression. Some samskar takes place. That means that that activity and our absorption in that activity has transformed our thinking. It's transformed our subtle body. Now, the subtle body stays with us a lot longer than the gross body. When we leave this world, when we pass away, the gross body is gone. Everyone can see the gross body is gone. But the subtle body remains. The subtle body carries us, the soul, to the next destination. So the subtle body stays for an extremely long period of time, and it is our companion throughout our journey through all the species. It is destroyed only when we finally quit this cycle. So this subtle body, mind, intelligence, and false ego, is being continuously transformed by every thought, action, deed that we do at every moment. So even if we do something and we free ourselves from the consequences of it through some process, the imprint in the mind, the taste for further sense gratification, has actually only been increased. It hasn't gone. Prabhupada gives the analogy of a fire. When some fuel is poured into a fire, you know, we have to have some special type of sense gratification. And we think, okay, let me just enjoy this, and then I'll be a little more peaceful. So Prabhupada says, yes, in the beginning, you pour a lot of ghee on the fire. What happens to the flames? They subside a little. But then once they start to consume that fuel, they become even more voracious. They become even stronger. And so anyone who's tried a bit of sense gratification, which is probably everyone, knows that it doesn't solve the problem. For a little while we feel satisfied, and then the urge rises again. And this time it's a little stronger. Because what we accepted before, whatever taste, whatever enjoyment, we're now used to it. So we need something slightly different. We need a stronger dose. We need something more. So you can see where this is going. The formula is that you want more sense gratification, more reactions will come. You will commit more sinful acts, and you will be stuck in this complicated cycle of birth and death. So it is very important that a culture should try to train its members how to get out of it, how to free this, how to free ourselves from this cycle. Now it's interesting that Yudhishthira Maharaj is the one who is making all these statements. In this one, he's specifically, in these last few verses and in this verse, he's dealing with the impact of destruction of tradition. When cultural traditions are lost, then many undesirable consequences happen. In particular, Yudhishthira has killed many, many people on the battlefield. He says here he has killed many friends of women. Now, why does he say that? This is very similar to Arjun's statements just before the war began, just before the battle began. He was very much concerned by this. Sankaro narakayeva kulagnanam kulasyacha patanti pitaro yesham lupta pindo dakakriyaha. That when traditions are destroyed, when varna sankara increases, when women of the family become corrupt, unwanted progeny arises, then offerings to the ancestors are stopped. Culture is stopped. The actual traditions that have been preserved and carried forth in generations are actually left aside. And these traditions, these guidelines, these mechanisms are actually what give us quality in life. So there's definitely an analogy for us in ISKCON with this type of thinking. That when family traditions are vanquished, Sri Sri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. Now, our family traditions are, of course, given to us by Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas. That is our devotional family in that sense. That we have ultimately the words of Krishna. We have the Acharyas, we have the Goswamis. We have the parampara, Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, Bhaktivinod Thakur, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, and all of his bona fide disciples who have acted to transmit and propagate this essential science. So Prabhupada and many others, notable persons like Bhaktivinod Thakur, have tried so much to preserve our family tradition, the family tradition of Krishna consciousness. So within that, as the Gita explains, that when traditions are destroyed, family becomes involved in irreligion. Irreligion gives rise to unwanted progeny. So what is our unwanted progeny? It could be preaching. Through preaching, one creates progeny. isn't it? There are two ways that one can have a son, it's described. Either through actually begetting a son through the normal process, or through actually bringing one into the family of Krishna. That is also considered a type of giving birth. So what happens is that that type of progeny isn't sufficiently strong, strongly situated in the dharma, guidance, institution, not institution really, but the scriptural strength of Krishna's teachings. So our preaching can become weaker and weaker when we destroy traditions. Each center, each family has its traditions. Each place in the world, each place of pilgrimage has traditions which have been maintained for years, for decades. In Kali Yuga, it doesn't take much to destroy traditions. It takes a committee meeting where the members of a committee may not be the most advanced persons. They may be on that committee somehow, having maneuvered themselves onto it. And decisions which will be made, which may remove decades of tradition, which have been practiced in different places. The consequence of that is, something has been lost. So Arjuna is very, very fearful about this. He knows he's going into a battle when the senior members of a society who are responsible for tradition have been removed, which is what happens in this battle. Arjuna was fearful that this would happen at the start. Yudhishthir has now seen that it has actually happened. And he's dealing with the consequence of it. When the guardians of that tradition are removed, then you end up with a whole path of degradation. It will start with something that seems very nice and very progressive. But it will end with a destruction of tradition, destruction of culture, destruction ultimately of the philosophy and mood of Krishna consciousness. When we read Prabhupada's books, there are different ways we read Prabhupada's books and understand them and absorb them. Through the Shastra, we get a lot of information. That's one component. We become knowledgeable about the universal order of things. We hopefully get some realization on these topics so that we can apply them in our lives. Prabhupada expertly in his purports tells us how to preach also. And then there are many different items which are not so explicitly drawn out, but which constitute Prabhupada's mood, the mood of the Acharya, the mood of Krishna, the mood of the devotees. There might not be an explicit statement about it, but we can understand different nuances from these moods. And a devotee doesn't just try to follow the content of Prabhupada's books. A devotee also follows, and this is very important, a devotee also follows the intent of Prabhupada's books. Arjuna had to follow Krishna's intention in the Bhagavad Gita, ultimately. And ultimately, Arjuna's success was that he followed Krishna's intention. Krishna presented to him all the different options. He said, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. The choice is actually yours. If you do this, this is what will happen. If you do this, this is what will happen. Yes, if you fight, there's a good chance you will die. But then as a Kshatriya, for you, there's no better death. So some disadvantages, some advantages on both sides. And ultimately, Arjuna is glorified by Srila Prabhupada because he followed Krishna's intent. Krishna's intention was to engage Arjuna in pure devotional service according to Arjuna's particular situation. So there are so many details, do this, do that. But the ultimate goal, the ultimate direction should never be forgotten. And often that intention, it's not so easy to decipher. This is why we have to spend a lot of time going through Prabhupada's books, talking to devotees. We're fortunate there are still some Prabhupada disciples left. We can ask them, how did Prabhupada clarify what appears to be contradictory things in the scriptures? We can still take some advantage of that. Because if we are to act as bona fide links in this chain, everyone here will be responsible for carrying on the process of instructing Krishna consciousness to someone else. And if we ourselves haven't understood it properly, if we ourselves are not wanted progeny in this line of preaching, what good can we do for this mission? We have to elevate ourselves to that stage. And it will happen by Krishna, Krishna's mercy, and the holy name. Now, I discussed from Prabhupada's purports that we end up in this complicated mesh. So for us also, there is a yajna to perform. And the Bhagavatam does explain this, that apanah samsritim ghoram yannama vivashogranan tato satyo vimuccheta yat bibheti swayam bayam. That persons entangled in the complicated meshes of birth and death can be freed even by unconsciously chanting the holy name of the Lord, which is feared by fear personified. Now, fear personified is probably quite fearful, but there is something that he is afraid of. And there is something that he is afraid of, and that is something that we will be protected from. So that's very important, that this holy name is our yajna for this age. So the principle of this hasn't changed. We overcome our sinful reactions by performing yajna. But this Harinam yajna, this chanting of the holy name, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam, these nine processes of devotional service, they do something that other yajnas cannot do. As I mentioned, these other yajnas, they are a bit like the elephant's bathing. One cleans oneself, then one feels a need to commit sin again. So the process of devotional service is the only process, actually, amongst all the different options given in the Vedas. You know, some people will say, you know, I'm a karma yogi, I'm a jnani yogi, I follow this path, I follow that path. All paths are equivalent. Even Krishna says in the Gita, after all, one who applies himself correctly to either one of the paths gains the results of both. That has to be understood. Because corresponding to that, Krishna also says, I consider one path to be superior. So we should be very, very clear that our path of devotion can do something that no other religious process can do. That something is that it uproots the propensity to commit sin. It uproots that propensity for sense gratification. Now, some of us may be thinking, I wish it would happen. We've been chanting, and we still want to enjoy our senses. We think, is it ever going to work? Is it actually going to happen? Well, probably there's a lot we're ignoring, actually. As devotees, as we've transformed, as we've moved forward in our devotional lives, there is a great deal that we're actually not doing that we did before, which was sinful. We should take great comfort from that. That actually our lifestyle now is a lot better than it was before. I doubt there's anyone who has come to the process of devotional service and has become more sinful. It doesn't really happen. Rather, one thing that's happened is that we've actually become more aware of our sinful behavior. So when we do something wrong, we lament. We actually feel dissatisfied. Whereas in the past, we would simply do that and just be oblivious, not even aware. Just in our mode of ignorance, we would simply transit through one experience to another, to another, to another, not even reflecting on the consequence of what I've just done. So now we do that more. And of course, as we progress, as we go forward, we become pure. We become genuinely pure. We become purified. We serve the senses of the Lord. Our own senses become purified. And so this process of devotional service is very nicely summed up in this sixth canto. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayanaha agam dunvanti kartsnena niharam yava bhaskaraha. Just as the fog is dissipated by the powerful rays of the sun, so simply by the practice of devotional service, one uproots the weeds of potential sinful action that are lying dormant underneath the ground. We may destroy the plant, the creeper of sin that is growing, or any kind of reaction. We're talking pap. I focus on pap because that's Yudhishthira's mood here. But punya is just the same. Piety. Those are also trees growing. So we can remove the trees by process of yajna, but only the process of devotional service will uproot that creeper, will free us from the tendency to commit more and more sins. So it's a very, very powerful process. And it may seem very difficult. It's certainly a task which other practitioners don't even attempt. At best, they attempt to remove their reactions. And another stage is they try to restrict themselves from committing any more. But because they haven't removed the propensity for sense gratification, they will naturally, inevitably continue to do the same. So I'll stop there. It's a very philosophical section. But let's see if there's any questions, comments.